Hey y'all, you're tuned into Assigned Sex Unarchived. I'm your non-binary cousin Sean Dawson, and this is a safe space where we're honest about what it means to show up as Black, trans, and genderqueer. Today we're having a conversation a lot of people are scared to have. Sex work, survival, and what empowerment actually looks like. My guest goes by Lady. Let's get into it.
So the thing with sex work, like, I didn't want to do it for one of two reasons. A, all the shame that we're taught, that's associated with it. All the shame that comes with it. Kind of like with anybody who grows up in a religious household or in the church, you are taught at a very early age to feel shame if you are anything but heterosexual. If you're anything but cisgender heterosexual, you are taught at a very early age to feel shame. And it's the same thing when it comes to sex work. So one of the things, that was one of the reasons why I didn't want to do it, because of all the shame that's associated with it. And on top of that shame.
When you first did you feel shame?
I sure did. I sure the fuck did. I felt so, I was like, what? Like, I went to school, you know, I have a degree. And I'm not saying that that puts me, listen, if there's one thing I've learned, and I'm not saying I went into the game thinking that I was better than anybody or that, but I was thinking, no, you know, I shouldn't do that because, you know, people, you know, my education was paid for by people. I did all this stuff. And, you know, I should try to do the quote, quote, right thing. You know, I grew growing up in a religious household and just, you know, that kind of stuff. But I've learned, like, you can have the degree. You can even have the day job making the money. And you still need that coin from escorting to keep that cushion underneath you. Everybody has a side hustle. They say work smarter, not harder. Escorting, if done right, you know, you do it responsibly. You pick and choose your clients the right way. It's working smarter because you come up on some hundreds of dollars in less than an hour. You charge an hourly rate, but the client usually don't stay for that 4 hours. So you just made hundreds of dollars in like 30 minutes.
What were like some of the biggest mistakes you made in the beginning?
I was always really careful about it. I feel like escorting. Oh, and I didn't finish my 1 point. With escorting, I feel like you kind of go into it wanting to be as careful as possible because you know the risk. It's high key. It'd be my personal life where I'd be risking shit and being messy. And it's like, Lord, why did I let that nigga smash raw? Or why did I suck him with no condom? And that's more like the personal. But when you're doing it for work, you kind of go into it with a different, you're going into it with the mentality like, yo, I have to make sure I don't catch nothing because this is how I make my money. Again, I kind of really eased myself into it because I was scary Mary. But yeah, so I didn't want to go into it really for the main reason of like all the shame. And again, it's that same shame that we're taught if you grew up in religion that like, if you're not a cis heterosexual, your existence is wrong. You should not, basically, you shouldn't be alive. And then you're taught to just kind of reject and all this other stuff. And so I felt that thing. And I, what I really wanted a boyfriend. And, you know, at what, 29? When that didn't come at 29, I was like, okay, forget it. Like, I'll just do this. This is not working out. I'm not getting the guy. The guy hasn't come. Many guys have come and gone for free. Sometimes it was under casual, with casual expectations. Other times it seemed as if it was going in the romantic direction. And every time I thought I was getting closer to that, it just didn't come. And then when I finally had that final straw at the age of 29, I was like, okay. So I eased myself into it. And then I had a homegirl who did it and she made all this money. And I was like, I know I can make. I may not be able to make as much as she makes because I don't look like her. But I know I can make some of that. I know I can make some of what she makes. And so I started smooth with, you know, happy ending body rubs, etc. And then eventually I graduated to, we can start with this massage. And if you want to upgrade for like $300 more, you can do that. And then when you start making that money and you see your financial stress start to decline, They're like, oh, I can do this.
Whenever you tell me about it, I'd be like, that shit just seems so unsafe, because I just know how, like, fragile masculinity is. Like, how do you screen these people?
People have different methods. My homegirl, she requires you send a picture. If you don't send a picture, she ain't gonna see you. And now, I used to not do that, because I ain't gonna hold you. Pretty privilege is a thing. And there are different tiers of pretty. And there are different tiers of pretty privilege. My friend is fair skin, long, silky hair, et cetera, et cetera. So men are more likely to tolerate her bullshit. And some don't. But some do. Most of them do, I feel like. But some of them don't. But she could get away with a lot more. I kind of felt like, I was like, well, you could pull that off because you ain't black. So her thing was, if you don't see the pic, I'm not seeing it, she's seeing you. And so at first, I didn't do that. I was too afraid to actually do that. It made sense and I understood why, but I needed the money. I was like, I need the money. So, and when it comes to this kind of work, discretion is paramount. You know, these men are public figures. Maybe they have families or, you know, whatever. Or they're, you know, important figures at work, et cetera. So discretion is key, and they're not going to have their pictures sent out there. And, you know, some of these, quote, workers be out here scamming people, and they fish for pictures, and they use it to blackmail people. So everyone's guard is up. So I never thought, I didn't think that would be the move, to just have someone send me a picture. So you kind of go based off of phone call. How do they talk when they speak to you? Does it sound like someone that's educated? Does it sound like somebody that's going to give you a hard time? Does it sound like someone who could be trouble? Are they high? Are they sober? And you can kind of see it in the text too. You know, are there spelling errors? So there's just ways to kind of look at it. Now I've kind of gotten into the habit of asking for pictures, because I blur my face now. I blur my face in my ads. And I say, if you want to see a picture of me, you have to send a picture of you. It's an easy exchange. And that works. Or sometimes there's a phone call. Or you just kind of check the text message to see how they message you. And you can pretty much, you can pick up on the riffraff.
Has there ever been an instance where somebody tricked you, or you've been in like a super dangerous situation?
You mean like a robbery or something?
Like a robbery, like a fight, like something that you, like your safety was, like you weren't safe and you had to get out of it.
Thankfully, no. And so there was a time where this client was, potential client, I ended up not seeing him. He sounded sketchy, but I went and met with him anyway because he was close by. And I met him at his place, and he just seemed too sketch. And I declined him, but he harassed me for like 2 months, and he would hit me up from different numbers. I'm gonna call my people on you, you know, all this other stuff. He's like, oh, you racist. It's like, no, I pick and choose. I don't have to entertain you. Another security aspect, another thing you do, if you have an apartment where you can see outside your window, you give the client the address to whatever building is you can see outside your window. Have them go there and then have them call you when they arrive. So then you can see them from your window and you can determine, you kind of screen them and determine whether or not this is someone you want to serve in. And there hasn't been an occasion where someone showed up and I had to turn them away, or like that hasn't happened.
I feel like that's just very, very lucky.
Well, it depends though, Shauna. I screen. I'm okay. Paying attention. How do you talk? How are you texting? Mm-hmm. There is a screening process, and sometimes you don't know. Sometimes you have no idea. Sometimes they don't want to call. Sometimes you're just going based off of a text messaging. You're just hoping for the best. But again, you look out that window, you make sure, and you have them call you when they get there, when they arrive. And then you can see them out your window, and then you can either direct them to the building that is yours, or you say, you know what, I'm sorry, today is not a good day for me to provide services to you.
Okay, so it's time for a little Black trans and genderqueer history. Today, we're centering the story of Cece McDonald. Cece's somebody who got put through the machine and came out on the other side saying something about the machine itself. Cece's story is not a history in the distant sense. It's a pattern we're still watching play out in real time. This year, 2026, a trans woman named Paulina Poe is filing a lawsuit from inside a men's prison, challenging the same kind of treatment Cece survived.
I can just say it's a really, really good feeling to be back with everyone and to actually use this platform that I have now to educate people and to inform people about the violence against trans women, about the prison industrial complex.
Cece was born in 1989 on the south side of Chicago. She knew who she was from early on, and her family made her pay for it. She ended up out of her house as a teenager, homeless, surviving on the streets of Chicago's Boys Town.
I pretty much had a hard life. I was out on my own since I was 14. And, you know, from sleeping on park benches and couch hopping and trying to figure out what I was going to do in my life. I really wanted to get a leg up, but it seemed like there was no opportunities for trans women in Chicago. And it seemed like every place I went into turned the backs on me or slammed the door in my face. And it was really hard for me to, like, figure out what I was going to do with my life. And then after some major consideration, I decided to move to Minnesota. After a friend had invited me.
June 2011.
A transgender African-American woman is facing trial for murder after an incident outside a Minneapolis bar where she was reportedly harassed and then physically attacked. Krishan Cece McDonald, who is 23 years old, is scheduled to stand trial later this month for second-degree murder. But supporters say McDonald was the victim on June 5th, 2011, after two women and a man, all of them Caucasian, began harassing her and her white friends outside a bar, calling them racial and homophobic slurs.
It starts with slurs, the kind that lets you know exactly what somebody thinks you are. And then one of the women in the group smashes a glass into Cece's face. 11 stitches. One of the men in the group, Dean Smits, had a swastika tattooed on his chest. This is an important detail because a lot of coverage of this case sits in the background. During the fight, Cece defended herself with a pair of scissors, Smits died, and when the police showed up, the person they arrested was Cece. Prosecutors went after her for second-degree murder, which carried up to 80 years. She took a plea deal for second-degree manslaughter, 41 months. The man with the swastika on his chest was dead, and the Black trans woman with glass in her face was going to prison for it. And because Minnesota decided to classify her by anatomy rather than by identity, they sent her to a men's facility. A woman who had just survived a white supremacist hate crime was placed in a men's prison, and the state called that a policy decision.
Yes, I was put in a men's prison.
You chose not to fight that, to be put in a women's prison?
Yeah, and my reasoning behind that was because after I did some educating myself on the prison industrial complex and the history behind African Americans and incarceration, I felt like sending me to any prison wouldn't solve my issue. Men's prisons, women's prisons, they're prisons and they're not good.
Inside, Cece wrote letters to the people fighting for her on the outside and got published and read across the country and eventually around the world. She was building an intellectual and political argument from inside a men's prison about why the whole system needed to come down. Not get reformed, but abolished.
So to live in a, like, literally a 10-by-10 room, and your toilet is by your bed, and, like, I can't even put into words that feeling, but it's just, like, the worstest, grossest, grimiest feeling that you could ever feel. And it's like, you know, and like I said, I was fortunate enough to be able to get out. You have to remember, some people are never going to get away from that. Some people have to deal with that for the rest of their lives.
The Free Cece campaign became one of the most visible trans justice campaigns the country had ever seen. Laverne Cox, before Orange is the New Black, made her a household name got involved, and eventually produced a documentary about the case.
Well, the moment I heard about Cece McDonald's story, I felt it was a microcosm of what so many trans women of color experience every day living our lives as ourselves. Cece was just walking down the street with her friends. They were going to the grocery store, and she experienced violence. She had to fight for her life. And when she survived, which a lot of trans women don't always survive. When she survived, her gift of survival was a prison sentence. She was criminalized for being Black, for being trans, and for surviving, I believe.
What Cece's story put into plain language was something activists had been saying for years without being heard. The system does not recognize a Black trans woman's gender until it's time to punish her. They will not put her in a women's shelter, will not hire her, will not protect her from the man with the swastika, but they will send her to a men's prison when she survives him. She got out in January 2014 after 19 months and kept going. I think this is an important piece of the story because a lot of people would have needed years to just breathe after what she went through. Cece came out and immediately got back in the work. She became a speaker, an organizer, and a voice in the prison abolition movement.
I never wanted this. You know what I'm saying? Like, I never, you know, thought that I could say I'm a leader. You know what I'm saying? Like, I never wanted that. And I would literally sit in my jail cell and be like, I don't want to be a leader. What do they want from me? I don't know. What do they want? And then it took for me to do my own self, you know, assurance and self-awareness and self-identifying to know that if I'm going to take this challenge, I'm not just doing it for myself. And that's what the overall bigger picture was, that it wasn't even just about me anymore.
Cece has made clear that her goal is not a more trans-friendly prison. She does not want a softer version of the horrible thing that she experienced. She wants the conditions that funnel Black trans women into cages in the first place to stop existing. She has made that argument in college classrooms, at conferences, in documentaries, and in interviews for over a decade now, refusing to soften it to make people more comfortable.
In the whole story, do I want to talk about the prison industrial complex? Is that something that people wanted to know? And then a part of me was just like, fuck it, I don't care if they don't want to know. You're going to know. So,
you're going to know.
So, you know, it really took me to go through all these different stages of educating and, you know, questioning and trying to figure out what's my place in this. And once I figured that out, that gave me the courage to kind of speak on those issues. Because a lot of times people don't want to speak about it. Even people who've been in those situations, it kind of makes them feel uncomfortable. And so, you know, I felt like there's no room for uncomfortability because I'm already uncomfortable. For the last 25 years, I've been uncomfortable.
When we talk about Paulina Poe filing a lawsuit from inside a men's prison in 2026, we are not talking about something new. We are talking about a pattern that Cece McDonald survived, documented, and has been warning us about ever since. She gave the movement her whole life as a case study and kept showing up. That is not something that gets taught enough, and that is exactly why we're talking about her today. I said, can you fight?
Can I defend myself?
Yeah, I mean, like, do you carry, like, weapons? Like, could you, like, would you go, like, head-to-head with, like, fists? Yeah,
I mean,
do you carry, like, pepper spray?
I like to think that I can defend myself, and I have pepper spray, but I keep that in my purse. And I have a cutter that I know where, like, all of my sharp objects are in my home if I ever need to do something. Mm-hmm. And if I have to throw hands, like, I have my gloves for that because I can't be scraping up my fingers, my knuckles. But it's never come to that. Also, I mean, you kind of hope the dude that I just told you about that was, like, threatening me later on, he came from this site. Typically, like, you post on a website that is more, like, higher, it attracts more higher-end clientele, and you just kind of hope that you don't attract any riffraff, but sometimes that's not always the gatekeeper from the riffraff. Like this last dude, he was from that site. And I was like, you found me on this website. It's a respectable site. I don't know why you're coming at me with this crazy riffraff trash. I don't deal with trash. I don't deal with riffraff. And you're giving me trash behavior right now. Like, that website is not for you. Go look somewhere else. You know what I mean?
So most of these men aren't Black.
Hell no.
Got it.
Hell, okay. But I don't post, you know, like, it might be, now listen, this might be different for the girls in the South. Like, the Atlanta girls, I don't know what that world is down there. Maybe the dude, the black man down there, they cool and stuff. And they're not going to give you a hard time. But no shade, like, black clients are usually, like, the most difficult clients. Like, mm-hmm. I would say, I mean, it's maybe a testament to the historical, the domino effects of history and you know, how this group of people, how one group of people had golden spoons and silver spoons, and the others kind of had to work a lot harder for it. So with black clients, they're usually more difficult. They want you to do more. It's like they're gonna give you a hard time about the rate, or it's typically it's not like a smooth exchange. Whereas with like Caucasian clients, it's usually a lot smoother of an exchange. Hispanic men that aren't like ghetto or hood, they're also smooth. But even like with just like not all, but just even like some of the educated black men, it just be like, it'd be too much. It's too much back and forth. Oh, why is it so much? Just like, this is the price, you know. But I will say, in New York, when I did a little bit of it there, the black clients that I had there, they didn't give me. One of them gave me a hard time when he came back the second time, but I had like maybe two or three, no problems. I was like, okay, this was smooth and easy and simple. But typically, like even with stripping, it was just like, the black men, they want you to do too much. And the other, while the other clients are a lot easier to please or impress, or it's just a smoother, easier transaction. Not even trying to stereotype, that's just what it is.
It's definitely stereotype.
No, it's generalizing. It's how it works. It's how it works.
No, it's...
And it's not... That's what I'm telling you. And I don't... Again, there's a screening aspect to it. Some girls can just take just anybody. I pick and choose.
That's scary, like, taking anybody.
Let me tell you something. When you need that coin, I know them girls. I know girls from the nightlife. A client was a client. They ain't care. They would get their coin. Sometimes they would even lessen their price. And I get it. It's smart. If you go through like 3 or 4 guys for a lower rate than your usual rate, you're still coming up. You're still making way more money. I get it.
What do you think people that are like looking in from the outside, they don't really know about it, like, what do they get wrong about the emotional labor that's involved? Because I feel like that's why your price should be high, because of the emotional labor.
There is emotional labor. It can be draining. It can especially be draining if you're not like into a guy, the person that you're servicing. Then it really works. And you know, sometimes they come over smelly, and it's like, you know, so now you gotta accommodate them. You gotta get a towel and shit for them to use your shower. You gotta clean up after, you know, it's like,
you gotta tell them to take a bath. Shower
sometimes, yeah. If a guy, it's happened. But you know, also the text that you put in your ad can, for the most part.
I want to hear part of your ad. Let me hear how this.
I kind of repel an ideal clientele. I have to see.
You ain't got to read it word for. I'm just curious. What's in your ad? Because I'm like, you like got to be like, nigga, take a bath.
No. I say please be hygienic and cleanly. And then I put, for example, showering before your session. Mm-hmm. But I used to not have that there. And sometimes guys would come over smelly, and I would have to, I'm like, yo, you gotta go shower. Like, you have to take a shower, and it's part of the time that you booked with me. But you know, making everything clear, setting your boundaries and making your expectations clear in your ad will help attract who you want to attract and repel who you don't want to attract. Mm-hmm. So that's a key factor. But then again, sometimes riffraff will find you or try to come your way or whatever. I like explicitly note, like, I prefer sober gentlemen. I can't do the people that are either drunk or on substances. But I know a lot of girls that make a lot of their money with those people. I mean, they're easier to take advantage of. They'll give you thousands and thousands of dollars because they're high and they're, you know, narked up. It's like, I get it. It's just, I don't want that kind of energy around me. Just because I know I've been around it in my personal life with guys that I dated, and I'm just like, this ain't for me. So I think this is just an ad. You know, there are girls that do it. They go out, you just wait in the lobby or go to a bar or something like that, and you get your client that way, which is, it's easier. It's easier. It's a bit more work, but it's easier from the standpoint of you screen. You know what you're getting, who you're getting for the most part. You gotta hope that he doesn't go batshit crazy on you in the hotel room, and you go from there. But with everything, that's a risk. Even with regular hookups, when you bring someone to your home for a hookup or from a date or something, we don't know if they're batshit crazy and they're gonna harm us, you know, during intimacy or anything like that. We don't know. There's always that risk factor.
I mean, you do. You seem like you have. You're a pretty good judge of character. Also, I know that you don't drink or smoke. So I know your head is like always like on straight, but I feel like usually people give you like red flags. Like I know of somebody crazy, like right off, like I can tell. Do you think that escorting is empowering?
I do believe sex work or what some call spicy work. I do believe it's empowering. We live in a world where especially men, I will always speak in the context of men because that's my life and who I service and who I pursue. In my romantic life, I live in a world where there are more men who will use you and take advantage of you for your body and leave you high and dry and brokenhearted, feeling hurt, with no remorse. They will use you and bounce to the next and then wipe up who it is they want to wipe up, and they just go on with your life, and you're left to deal with what they left behind, mm-hmm. the damage that they left behind in your life. So sex work is a way to take that power back, to get your power back. Yep, it creates an exchange where you're not walking away empty-handed. You're walking away fiscally better than you were prior. One step financially ahead better than you were before. And when it comes to T-girls, yes. I mean, everyone does sex work, not just T-girls. Like men do it. There are straight men that are gay for pay all over, and they are fine. Gay for pay models, dancers, go-go boys, etc. Everyone does it. Everyone does it. It just so happens that in our community, because we are a minority, it gets more of the spotlight. But when you, especially if you're like pre-2020, if you wanted to transition, it depends on your standard, however you want to transition. Some of us want body. Some of us want face. Some of us want a real cosmetic reinvention of ourselves. How the hell are you going to finance that? Working a job and then dealing with like transphobia and all this other shit on a day to day until you can reach that goal, or you could go do some sex work and make a lot more money in quicker time, save up, and then get the surge, get the work that you want to have done. Now they have the insurances are covering it, which is interesting, but certain insurances are covering everything. They're covering facial film. They're covering everything. Some are even covering hair transplants. I'm not saying all, but it's back in the day when I started out, that was not the case. It was not. But now, yeah, back in the day, it was just like, so how are you going to pay for these procedures you want done? Because mm-hmm. you need that kind of money. So you got to do some kind of sex work. Yes, the girls who do it is usually the girls that have, you know, they look the most extravagant. They got the bodies, they got the face, they got the hair, they got the hair weaves, they got the materialistic things, the hot, quote-unquote, high-end materialistic stuff, like, it's like, okay, yeah, you're definitely doing it. You're definitely, like, 9 times out of 10, you probably got all of that through doing sex work. And there is nothing wrong with that. But no, say everybody's fucking. How many bitches, for something, how many bitches you fucked the guy because he bought you dinner? You fucked the guy because he took you home? You fucked this person because, you know, you're married to them and they have the lifestyle that you want? You date this person because you want access to the... We all out here hoeing. You know, mm-hmm. It may not be as explicit of an exchange. It may not be as explicit of an exchange as here's cash for my body. Give me the cash for my body. But there's an exchange there.
All right, y'all. That's all I got for today. If you'd like details on the archival audio featured in this episode, check out the show notes. If this episode dragged you a little bit, or if it hugged you a little bit, please share it with someone you love. You can find me, your non-binary cousin, Sean Dawson, on all platforms at I Am S. Dawson. Y'all be safe out there.